So hello everybody, and welcome to this edition of the ASI cast. And I'm delighted to say that today we're joined by Professor Karen Nelson-Field, founder and CEO of Amplified Intelligence. So hi there, Karen.
Hi, thanks for having me. Nice to see you.
Yeah, you too. So Karen, I you know, sort of quick trip down memory lane. I think the first time I met you was about 9 years ago, about 2013, 2014, something like that. And I think
Gosh.
You were then at the University of South Australia, and you were, I remember you were on a sort of tour presenting to Unilever around the place, around Europe, and you came to London, and a friend of mine I know who helped you with this called me up and said, oh, I'm putting on this event this evening and you might like to sort of come along and meet this brilliant.
I do remember that.
You remember that? And he said, I know she's talking about something you might be interested in. So I came along and you introduced me and of course subsequently everybody else to the world of attention. So you're like the sort of the godmother, I suppose, of attention. That was way back when. And what I think is kind of really interesting is that it's only taken, I mean, in the overall scheme of things, it's not a terribly long time to go from the whole issue of measuring attention was a sort of bit of a sort of project thing, wasn't it? You would sort of do project work on particular things. You did maybe particular countries, particular media, particular clients. And we now seem to be at a stage where it's becoming part of the kind of mainstream, almost like part of the mainstream currency, isn't it? I mean, is that how you see it? I mean, it seems to have evolved considerably.
Look, I do. But I also think those projects are important, right? So the validation studies. So to this day, I'm glad we built them and I'm glad we took our time, because every single time we went to a new country, we would test different boundary conditions, and every single, you know, format or platform that we would test was to understand different nuances. So, you know, we're now at a point where we're just seeing basically the same kind of results across different conditions. So we're at a point now where we can use that data, to your point, to now actually scale up and predict at, you know, the bidding and the verification play. But you know, the business has changed. But as I said, I looking back, it was really important for me to do two things, to work out whether attention was even valuable. A, you know, does it do what it says it does? Does it actually, you know, if attention is gained, does it actually lead to outcomes? But more importantly, was it different? So the last thing I wanted to do was to build yet another metric that really didn't offer, you know, anything different that was already in market. So those projects were super valuable for that.
So what got you into this in the first place there? Did you sort of think, just looking around you at sort of advertising and the way in which people were consuming media, did you just think, oh, we're just measuring a kind of very, very broad sort of base level and we can do better than that? Was that where you kind of started from in the beginning?
Not really. So, you know, originally, I mean, I'm getting old now, but originally my PhD was in audience measurement. So I looked at traditional measurement in TV, print, actual print, magazines, actual magazines, and radio. And so when you've done a PhD and you get offered a postdoc, you get to choose an area of interest, right? And it was at a time when the Facebook was around, and YouTube had maybe 10 followers or whatever, not quite like that, but it was really, really early days. And I went, this is interesting, because there's all these new things called social that are coming and no one really knew what it was about. And I thought, you know, what might be interesting is to see whether I was with Ehrenberg Bass. So they're all about generalizability and, you know, new conditions, test it. And I thought, I wonder if what I've learned in my PhD would actually apply in this new world. I wouldn't even have called it digital at that time. I wouldn't have had a clue what it was. And so that's where it started. But I quickly became aware, when I say quickly, you know, within a few years, quickly became aware it just doesn't, it didn't marry. There was something that was different about this side of media and that side of media. And, you know, fast track 15 years and I literally know the original sin and the core nucleus of the problem. But then I went, this doesn't make sense. So I started to get interested in the why there was difference. So the cause of it and the consequence to advertisers. And that's kind of what drove me to where I am today.
Yeah. And it was interesting, certainly when I met you, it was an advertiser-driven thing, wasn't it? In the sense that you were going around certainly I mentioned Unilever. You were going around then, I think, on a sort of Unilever trip. And what's the impetus for this early on? It came from advertisers rather than anybody else, I guess.
Well, in Unilever, you know, I owe a lot to, because they actually invested. I was head of a research centre at the uni, and they actually invested in exactly, because, you know, at the time their CMOs were challenging the viewability, standards. I mean, you know that history. And so their CMO sort of said, you know, is one impression equal to another? And I went, oh, Christ, I need to work out how to actually measure that. So they came to me and trusted me with this. And, you know, that was a 12, maybe even 15-month project where I started to dabble in what on earth am I going to look at that's an alternative to MRC or to viewability at the time. And how can we even sort of start to measure equity across impressions? So it was super early days. But even then, with fake portals, because I just thought, well, naturally, I should really, because what I kind of worked out is there's no real measurement of humans anymore. So maybe I should go back to that, because, you know, when I did my PhD, that's how survey data was, you know, was driven, and reach data. So I thought, oh, I should do some sort of clever ethnographic thing where I'm, you know, viewing people, viewing media. And then I went, well, how the hell am I going to do that at scale? And so I started to think about, you know, and I came across the concept of computer. So this is way before Gaze was a thing, like way, way. And dabbled in it, did some really clunky work, but it showed systematic sameness across three countries. And, you know, I kind of went, wow, there's something in here. Viewability is failing this company, and they are correct to be questioning it. So I left the uni after that project and thought, I need to do some more validation, but I can see a vision here.
Yeah. I mean, it is worth going through this sort of what people may see as sort of ancient history, because this emerged from, as you say, your original work on audience measurement. I mean, that's what you were doing. You were studying audience measurement. You were an expert in audience measurement. And then you sort of took it on a stage. And it seems to me now that the rest of the industry is kind of catching up with this and saying, you know, for all sorts of reasons, largely driven, I think, by the emergence of digital, of online, I suppose we should say, and the major platforms, and the fact that they are measuring something that is not really open to much verification, and so on and so on and so on. We're now at a stage where the sort of whole basis and structure of the old-fashioned sort of audience measurement is starting to be questioned, just like it was with you, just like you did like 10 years ago. And so the fact that we've sort of arrived at this point is, I find, quite interesting, because it emerged from a very solid place in understanding how to measure audiences.
Yeah, it's an interesting one, because what I will say is it's not about just going, oh, here's a metric and look at, here's some outcomes, and therefore we have a measurement solution. For me, it's about understanding it really, really deeply. Call me crazy. But what I do know about understanding it really deeply, which is, what is the core problem? How is that relative? How does it work really at grassroots level? Means that we can build something as a business that makes a difference. So I can see quite clearly at the point at which measurements started to fail, and it started to fail when we stopped measuring humans and started to, which, you know, we used to know what humans did, and then we started making assumptions about what humans, and that was the critical point in time when it went, basically when I started to study this right back then, when everything changed and the assumptions are wrong when you don't use human data. But it's kind of swinging around now. And I think, you know, I presented this at CES where, in my personal humble little opinion, the need for a combined set of data is really vital. So yeah, it's been fun.
What do you mean by a combined set of data?
So there's two sets of attention data that's sort of dropping in the industry. And for a while there, so where I get a bit cross is, you know, people are still focusing on the definition of attention. The definition of attention has been in literature for years. Where we're struggling as an industry, because that's come from psychology, right, around how people pay attention to stuff. And that's easily defined. What we're struggling with as an industry is the complication around how to operationalize that, right? So there are two types of data that are sort of dropping. One is the human side, which is where we started. So that's done through human panels at scale. I mean, and clearly we live in a scaled world. So a panel of, you know, 500 people, repeat, rinse, repeat, rinse, repeat isn't going to work, nor does labs or anything like that. So we need a scaled solution to be able to basically film people interacting in real time in their real environment, in their real platforms. And that kind of has now kind of evolved into quite deep technology using, you know, facial detection, facial recognition, pose estimation, gaze based tracking. And then you have the, and so that data is basically translated into whether someone's like, I'm looking straight at you right now, I'm actively paying attention to your face, but when I look over here, you know, I'm near you, but I'm not looking at you, right? And then the second type of data is impression data, which is what has been in the industry for a while, which is tagging on the back of creative and understanding time and view and, you know, how many pixels and coverage and scroll speeds and all that sort of stuff. And what we've learned is that, you know, all of those things I just mentioned are indicators of attention, but they're also indicators of non-attention. So when you've got a model based on impression tags alone that doesn't understand in what context and in what formats what weighting should be applied, it fails. So what we can see now is that this, but the problem with human data is it's super expensive and hard to scale. Like, you know, you've got hundreds and hundreds of thousands of views, not billions of views, right? So the future of attention economics is using panels as a ground truth. So scaled panels, not small ones, scaled panels that are essentially filming people interacting with platforms and using that as the ground truth because it's highly accurate because it is actually what people are doing. And then using that as a ground truth to then predict or train, if you like, the impression tags that are running billions of impressions per day, but training them with the right nuances and the right weightings and the right circumstances. Classic example is most people think that a certain size format has the same amount of attention gained on this platform as it does in this platform. It's not at all. So adding the ground truth to the impression data is the future of attention economics.
And presumably at some point you're going to have to, one has to assume that not all creatives are the same either, of course. I mean, you know, different levels, different types of creative will obviously deliver different levels of attention, or different creative treatments will attract different levels of attention. So eventually you're going to have to get down, presumably, to tagging ads or doing something with specific ads.
So what's interesting about that, and this is, you know, in some way serendipitous in the way that we set up the test controls, you know, you and I are both researchers from way back. So we set up these validation studies so that we'd actually control for creative. So we understand within an inch of its life how platform functionality affects a human's attention. And then when you layer in, because we also collect in the wild data, so we built a system where we could actually replace your ad in your Facebook feed without you knowing, and also have the same ad running in your TikTok feed without you knowing if you're on TikTok. So it's the way we set up the validation studies from way back that gave us so much information about how to isolate the effects of media. So now we collect, you know, in the wild data all the time from creative. But what we've learned, Brian, is really important. And it's not to say creative isn't important, but it doesn't have the same ability to gain attention as you think. So the platform functionality and the format that it sits within, the platform, is the single biggest indicator of how much attention you will gain from your creative. Creative's job is to kind of, and there are boundaries of that, right? So creative will only work within those boundaries. So we know that creative plays a role, because at the end of the day, if the ad doesn't say who it's for, you will not get a sale. So by far, because a lot of creatives take me out of context when I talk about that, without a doubt, it's going to get you the sale, but it doesn't drive the attention on a platform that you think the platform gives you the attention or the stage, and your creative works it works its magic on that stage. So there is still good creative and there's still bad creative, but you have this amount of time on that stage and you can either have a really great message or a really average message, and that's the job that creative plays. So
So that would talk to having different creative on different platforms, obviously, and different, because you have to appeal in different ways.
100%. So again, there's a boundary. So we see it all the time. So pretty average creative will get a small amount of attention, and it'll get a little bit more if it's a little bit better creative. So there is, yes, 100%, you still have to have good creative. Yeah. And fit for format is a big thing that most people don't do. And often it's interesting because that is a lot to do with the branding component too. So they put a standard ad on. I just did a piece a couple of weeks ago where I just took a random 1,000 brands or something, or 1,000 ads, and I could see that in about 80% of the time on web, for example, the branded moment fit or sat at a point when less than 20% of the reach was even looking. Mm. So if you think about what that does to your opportunity to even link that brand to you, it's huge. So that comes from a creative play, right? So if you understand how much attention you can get on a general web with an MREC, you can build your creative around it.
So what do you make of all this talk of, I'll use other people's words, not mine, but alternative currencies? You know, the fact that there's a lot of talk now about measuring things in different ways or through different providers. And I mean, is attention, do you see attention sort of being built into these currencies in some way, or?
It already is.
So
it already is. And I love that because I love the fact that we're disaggregating, because I don't believe it will be a currency unto itself, you know, and some of my competitors will just laugh and I don't care, because I actually think its job, I think disaggregating is safer. And I think then each of them validate each other and, you know, whether it's the most cost-effective, I don't know, but I don't think one provider can do every single thing in the entire world and then we trust it with its independence, you know. So I love the idea of a disaggregated currency, because I think as technology improves, then the new providers can come in as different measures, you know, beyond attention, you know, to your point of creative. Maybe there's some sort of nuanced AI creative that can be added on top of everything. Like I love it. It just means that you can build your own. Yeah. And the globe has an opportunity to not be beholden to, you know, two or three players. But yeah, it's so in CES, they're already talking about it being an advanced currency, not an alternative currency. Yeah. So I think it's coming. It's definitely coming. And that's where I see it playing. And, you know, the reality is if we had one attention currency, I think it would be gamed. And I think what will happen is we'll only have like an advanced viewability version and it'll be gamed just like viewability is.
Yeah. I mean, that's the trouble, is, I mean, people sort of kind of think that everything is black and white. You have to have only impression data and everything else is rubbish, or only attention data and everything else is rubbish. Whereas the truth is, of course, all these things need to be blended together. I mean, it's the old analogy of, you've got to get the ingredients together before you make the cake, you know, and then you can make the cake. You know, otherwise,
100%. So just get the best ingredients and bake the best cake and eat it. Yeah. Yes.
And otherwise, you're going to finish up with a crap cake or no cake, you know.
Totally.
And that's the problem. So it's going to be. I mean, and how do you see? I mean, eventually, of course, what we presumably are striving towards is advertisers, or, you know, users knowing that if they do a certain thing, go down a certain course, take a certain course of action, whatever it may be, building in attention, not building intent, whatever, that will increase or decrease the likelihood of selling more beans, right? I mean, that's presumably what we're aiming towards. So eventually this stuff needs to fit together with some form of econometrics or modeling, or, you know, something that measures effect, a business effect. I guess that's how you see it too, right? That's
yeah, we do. And, you know, when we first started this business, we were quite closed to licensing data, for example, because, you know, it can end up with bad actors and it doesn't work. But now we are, you know, all of our data is API'd and, you know, it's a lot more technologically controlled. So we actually are, I'll be honest, we're opening up it to an ecosystem play, which means that we have features that people can use and license in their own stuff. So a big part of that is econometrics. So we don't want to be the data owner and all the systems owner. And we just think there's the way that this industry will grow is to enable others that are trying to achieve better return on investment. Econometrics is a big part of that. And other workflow systems are already in our remit as well. So we're all in for sharing.
Yeah. I was listening to a very interesting talk actually yesterday by an analyst over here. And what he was talking about was how important it is these days for marketing people to understand they have to speak the language of the board. They have to speak the CFO's language, the CEO's language. And he was saying that at the moment that just doesn't happen. I mean, I've heard this story for more years than I care to remember. I know this is we all know this is a big problem. But he said something which I thought was very, 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 it was very important. He put it extremely well. He said, when you go and talk to a CFO or CEO, don't focus quite so much on the outputs, because what they want to know about is the inputs. What they want to know about is how accurate, how good is the data going in. His point being that once you've got the data, don't start at the other end, in other words. Start at the end of actually...
That's really interesting.
I thought it was a very good point, actually. It was a very well-made point.
So last year, I was lucky enough to present at the WFA in Athens, and that was my whole remit there. So dirty data in, dirty data out, right? And so, you know, as an industry, I think I couldn't agree with you more, because, you know, you really need any, if it's real measurement, it should have rules, right? And it should have rules around its, you know, privacy and continuity and uniformity and, you know, all of those things. We've got, I think there's about 7 of them that we adhere to. So, and a lot of that is mathematical norms as well. So 100% align, you know, data that is used in measurement should have a major set of rules for it to tick the good quality data box. Yeah. Because once you've got it in your system, it's pretty hard to unsee dirty data. Yeah. And then everything goes awry because all your models, all the flow and effects, you know, you're seeing stuff that's not real.
Yeah. He also made another very good point. I think somebody asked a question about, yeah, but once you've done your model, He said, absolutely not. No. He said, things change all the time. He said, you don't think the CFOs are sat there looking at financial models and saying, oh, we've done that, move on. They're changing it, amending it, circumstances change. Everything, new things come along. So we have to be flexible enough, to your point about build your own kind of thing. You need to be flexible enough to add in new considerations as and when they appear.
Yeah, well, I'll tell you a little story, because when I started working through this industry a few years back, you know, coverage and pixels were the thing. And I'm like, oh my God, you know, there's only a couple of variables and, you know, that's going to be reasonably stable until a platform perhaps changes its format. But then the deeper you go and the more you understand individual level human behavior, there are more indicators underneath that change. So on an aggregated level, probably stuff doesn't change. But when you've got a tool that's aggregated, there's also a greater risk of it's a chance that it works or not. But when you actually start to scratch below the surface, I mean, we can get down to the individual level and understand, you know, what type of viewer they are, whether they're a consistent viewer and they kind of look straight at the screen, or whether they're like a real flicker, or, you know, all that sort of stuff. And those things lead to different outcomes, right? So that's the kind of feed you want, because it becomes highly predictive, highly predictive.
Yeah, and you need to be able to be flexible enough, and your system needs to be flexible enough to take into account new things as they come along. Someone's going to invent something new tomorrow morning, and we better be able to cope with it, or at least come up with some way of making some sort of judgment about it, rather than just sort of going, oh, well, Craig, we've got our model, you know, fit with us. That's not the way of the world. You've got to change your thinking to adapt to new things and new entrants.
Oh, just the error that I've seen in, you know, the course of understanding all of this in the last 5 years, even, where people have had models that have sat there for even a few years and they've not changed it. And, you know, just the, like I said, the flow on effects from not changing or from any kind of bad tool is huge. So it's flow on effects to you know, share of voice, share of market, it's you know, how much you spend, your sales, your cost of goods sold, your, you know, your MMMs, your econometrics, your reach curves. Huge. Yeah. I mean, we're focusing on that at the moment. So we're about to drop attention adjusted reach curves into our planning tool because people don't understand the volume play and what they're paying for and what they're delivered is so different. So that has blown effects to brand growth, right? Mental availability tracking. Huge.
Yeah, enormous. Okay, well, you know, I think we pretty well solved the problems of the world now, Karen. I mean, as always.
We have.
Yeah, that's okay. We'll just do that. If you wouldn't mind having that finished by tomorrow morning, your time, that would be great.
Sure, yeah, no problem.
That should be okay. So thanks very much indeed for joining us on this ASI cast, and we very much hope we can talk to you again on a conference platform sometime soon. Thanks, Karen.
Thank you for having me.
Cheers now.